This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome, everybody, to the National Museum, and I think we're in for a treat this morning, so I'm very, very happy to see you all here today. My name's Adam Blackshaw, and I'll be one of the microphone runners, so you'll see us and Leanne outside running up and down with microphones. To my left is Stephen Munro, one of the museum's curators, and Stephen's responsible for putting together the display on Peter down in the Eternity Gallery. So this is why we have Peter here. And at the end of this session, feel free to go downstairs and have a look at that. And, of course, to the left of Stephen is somebody that you know quite well, a man who knows a little bit about gardening, but I suspect knows a lot about life, and that's pretty much why we've got him here today. We are recording this session, and I've got good news and bad news for you. The good news is, if you've ever wanted to be Michael Parkinson or Andrew Denton, here's your opportunity. We're not going to wait to the end of the session for questions. We're going to try to do it throughout the session. So if we can get a word in edgeways. And Stephen will be determining who gets to answer, ask those questions of Peter. So we'll do that throughout the session. The bad news is, yeah, he does know a lot about gardening, but he's also got, you know, much more experience than that. So we may just limit the sort of nasturtium and gardenia-type questions today. So, but please welcome Peter Cundill and Stephen Munro again. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Adam, and thanks for coming. Yeah, I obviously, we would have liked to have got Andrew Denton here today or George Negus, but they weren't available. So you'll have to put up with me. And as Adam said, I'm in the Eternity section. And I was fortunate enough to work on the story that we've just put together for Peter Cundill, which is downstairs now. So please take the time to go and have a look at the Eternity Gallery. But it became very obvious during the research for the story that Peter is more than just a gardener. We obviously know him well from his work on TV. But just to give you a rundown of the sort of things that Peter has done throughout his life, obviously born in Manchester, 1927, 1st of April, so happy birthday for... that's no joke. 1st of April, so 82, 2 days ago. Left school at 12, conscripted in 1945. Worked as a paratrooper in the British Army. Helped liberate the concentration camps in southern Austria. Guarded SS guards who ran those camps. He was accused of spying when he inadvertently crossed into enemy territory, becoming one of the earliest victims, I guess, of the Cold War. Was locked in solitary confinement as a result of that for almost 6 months. Saw active duty in Palestine. Enlisted with the Australian Army in England so that he could migrate to Australia, where he believed he'd be working in a library on Bondi Beach, but instead was sent to Korea. Worked as a weapons instructor on his return to Australia and, in his own words, churned out hundreds of pacifists. Ran as a politician, didn't even vote for himself. And, of course, a pioneer of Australian broadcasting and one of Australia's most successful radio and television broadcasters. And also a high-profile environmental activist. So a wonderful life story so far, Peter.
Well, I fell asleep while you were talking, actually. And look, I've had a weird life. And I'm glad that I've had a strange life. I've been around a fair bit. I've made some marvellous mistakes, and I've learnt from them, because I've always believed that if you make a blunder and you don't do something to correct it, you've made two blunders, you see. And so I find that being alive is wonderful, you know. I mean, I'm amazed that I'm still alive, the things that I've done, and the places I've gone, and the things in which I've been involved. Yes, it's a great life as far as I'm concerned. And it has been. Look, to be 82 years old, and there's probably one of you, two of you here, I see the odd grey hair, or bald head or whatever. It's good to be old. I can't see anything wrong with it. You know, there's always this great fear of becoming old. The only thing I've had, the driving force, if you like, of my life, has always been thinking to myself, when I get old, I'd never like to be totally dependent on somebody else because of lack of health. And so I spent a great deal of my life making sure that I didn't get sick and that I remained healthy all the time. And probably that's one of the reasons why, among other things, I became involved in gardening and especially growing things, and particularly growing the very best food you can eat, which is that you can grow yourself without chemicals or poisons, you know. But it's great to be 82 years old, in perfect health, right, and I am, with nothing wrong. But it's not, as people say, God, you're lucky. It's nothing to do with luck. It's to do with determination to make sure that you remain healthy. I mean, during World War II, as a soldier, and like most other soldiers, a lot of people may remember this if they've been in British Army, every day you were issued with 50 cigarettes. A round tin containing 50 cigarettes.
Every day.
Free. And that was it during the war. That was one of the things you got. And I used to think you had to smoke them all. And my fingers were so covered with nicotine, I used to peel off the skin. Could it kill the skin? And my teeth were so brown, like all the others, you know, that I couldn't get them clean. And it was really weird. And yet, in 1955, in Australia, and I was then, I couldn't keep up with the 50, I used to give them away or whatever, but you couldn't resist getting them. No, there's your 50, right? Private condo, there's your next 50. And I used to just chuck them away, what I couldn't smoke. But about 1955, I was still smoking about 15, 20 a day, thinking nothing of it. And then one day on ABC Radio, I heard the very first broadcast about the link between smoking cigarettes and lung cancer. And it was so convincing that not only did I instantly stop smoking, I enjoyed the cravings. I thought, serves you right, suffer, you see. And I've never smoked since. And I've since found out that if you smoke and you stop smoking, within half an hour of stopping, you're already returning back to health. That's how marvellous the human body is.
Yeah. You were born, obviously, in Manchester, and you grew up, in your own words, in quite a poverty-stricken neighbourhood with a family who lived in poverty. But you had a very happy childhood.
Yes. A lot of people seems like almost like a contradiction. Here I was, you know, when I was born, my parents didn't have a home. They were homeless people. That wasn't unusual. So were millions of others, right? And what they did would rent a room somewhere, and then if they had no money, they would flit at night to another room, right? I mean, and that was my early life. And yet, as I was growing up, it was an unbelievably happy time. Because, you see, when a child is very poor and hungry and don't have things, you don't miss what you've never had. And being hungry is just the same feeling as wearing clothes. That's a normal way to feel. And not being able to get things is quite normal. So it was quite normal to look in a window and see sweets or fruit or whatever that you couldn't get. And there was no urging and thinking, oh, I wish I could get that. You just look at it almost with wonder. There's a marvellous story that I repeated recently when I was on a television programme called First Tuesday that impressed me enormously, and it's from the great book by John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath. And in this story is one incident in that book, that great book about this family, this poverty-stricken family that had been driven off a farm and they were travelling across America in the 1930s at times of great unemployment, and there was also enormous drought in Oklahoma. And these people had no money, they were in these old cars. And it described an incident which brought me right back to being a child. And that was where this couple with their children in an old car stopped at one of these wayside coffee places, right, and stopped there to go inside. Now, they didn't have enough money to buy anything. He just wanted some water from the tap for his radiator. He also wanted not a loaf of bread, but half a loaf, right, because that's all he could afford. Yeah. And so he went there, and the people in there were tough people, working-class people, but tough, right, and a couple of truck drivers there. And these two little boys came in, and they're looking at some sweets. Like, I think they were lollipops. Just looking at them. And Steinbeck described the look in their faces, of their looks, not as wanting it, because they knew they couldn't get it, but just as an act of kind of wonder, the same as we'd look if you went into the Tower of London to look at the crown jewels. You'd look at that, and they were looking. And the father saw them looking and said to this woman, "Oh, how much are they?" And she said, "Oh, 2 pence. And he looked and he said, "Oh, in that case, yes." And he passed it across. And she took 2 of them, he gave them 1 each. And the boys took them, and they didn't look at them. They were so excited. And they just put them by the sides and just held them there stiffly. And then both ran out and climbed back into the car. And when the man left, one of the truckies said to this woman, "Look, you just sold those for 2 pence, but they're really 1 pence each." And she said, "Oh, shut up," you know. And it was this kindness that does exist amongst poor people. Poor people, without question, are the most generous people on earth. That's my experience. And I think that's probably the reason why, as a child, it was such a happy childhood. We were in a district where I lived where everybody was poor, where only one person in almost every street had a job. And I thought, as a child, that a rich person, a rich kid, was a kid whose father had a job. That was wealth, right? I couldn't think of anything beyond that. One of the interesting things about poverty, and men in particular, who are feeling deprived or humiliated because they can't get a job or because they have nothing to do, there's in those days, a lot of wife battering went on. My father used to bash my mother, right? And quite often her face would be quite black and blue where he'd punched her. It was the frustration. You get it everywhere. You get it here amongst people in some of the Aboriginal communities or some of the outer suburbs of Melbourne and Sydney and Launceston, where you get men without work, they check it out on their wives. In where I live, no one ever thought of calling the police. My mother was a woman of enormous strength, fortunately for me and our family, with, you know, 6 kids. So much so that even though she was beaten up and eventually my father disappeared, other women would often come to see her. And you'd see them walking into the house with their 2 black eyes, and they'd go with my mother, and my mother would talk to them. And they were explaining how they were. My mother did something that was quite unusual, that every woman here would appreciate. She said, "We can't have this." So she went round to all the other women in the area, about 10 or 15 of them. And they were fairly big women. And they took the woman, and if the bloke had a job, they'd take her to his work, where he was sitting there having his lunch with his mates, and say, "Look what he's done to her. Look what he's done." And show him up. But not only that, they'd say to him, "And when you come home tonight, we'll be waiting." And he knew it. And there was nothing he could do about it. And he'd come along and all these women were there, and they'd belt him up. They'd belt him up, right? And that was it. It stopped it. You know, it really did. And my mother was an extraordinarily impressive lady. I remember saying to her, when she was quite old, I said, "Look, is it true that you were actually working when you were only 8 years old?" She was born in 1891. "Is it true you were actually working in a factory at 8 years old. And she said, "Oh, no, love." I said, "Well, how old were you?" She said, "Five." I said, "What on earth would you be doing as a five-year-old?" She said, "Minding babies." She was given three or four babies where women were working with a bottle containing some water and some half a can of sticky condensed milk, which she'd spoon in. When one of the babies cried, she'd give them that to suck, right? And so she'd have three or four babies, and that was her job as a five-year-old. What it did, it gave her the most extraordinary experience and, above all, incredible compassion for people. And so from her, what she taught me and my brothers and sisters was to never be afraid of asking people for things. If you ever you're lost, she said, always ask a bloke, a working bloke, because you can trust them. But you can't trust the blokes in suits, really, because they'll never know they want to take you away somewhere. And she said that, and above all, a total opposition to any form of discrimination against women, against people of a different race or colour or whatever. That was the thing that I was raised with. And that's been a driving force in my life, right? Any form of discrimination is so unjust and so terrible. And if sometimes in Australia, I know that you will have experienced it, or in Britain, but in Australia, quite often in a room of people, somebody comes up in a room, a party, and starts to tell one of these Aboriginal jokes, which really are a total disgrace because they humiliate Aboriginal as being fools or worthless or whatever. And I always interrupt. I hear someone going on, and that's going to be a racist joke, and I don't think it's funny. I spoil the party. I spoil it. I won't allow it. And what does happen afterwards, when this creep has gone, it's usually a bloke, people come up to me and say, "I'm so glad you spoke up. I'm so glad." And I say, "Why the bloody hell didn't you? Why didn't you speak up? You've got to speak up, right?" And I get into a lot of trouble. I don't care. I must tell you this because it is interesting and you may not agree with you what I'm going to say. I don't care because it's a point of view. About a month ago, oh, no it wasn't, it was in on Australia Day, I came to Canberra. And I came here because I had won the Australian of the Year for Tasmania, and I was one of the finalists. And they said, among the things that you've got to do here, the finalists are going to have morning tea with the Prime Minister. I thought, right, I want to have a word with this bloke. So we went to the lodge. Right? And so we're there standing in a queue, and I'm at the end, and there's Kevin and Therese, smiling away, shaking hands, pat, pat. And I'm getting closer. And I wanted to say to him, we've just had a war in Gaza where 1,500 people were killed. The overwhelming majority of them were women and children. And your government has said nothing about this slaughter of these people who've done nothing wrong. Why not? Right? That was on my lips. So we got there and he looked at me. I opened my mouth to say it. He threw his arms around me and said, "Oh, Peter, I just like you so much." Right? That I was totally disarmed and lost my nerve. And all I could say was look out at his lawn and roses and say, "What a disgrace. What a disgrace. Where are your carrots and your tomatoes and your potatoes?" And to my astonishment, he said, "I completely agree." And so his wife said, "We'd love to have a vegetable garden. We'd love to have an organic." I said, "I'll come here and get one going for you if you like." They said, "We'll be in that." Right? So I'm going to push this one because now it started to ricochet off into other things. I found out yesterday, for example, that now they're having competition. They started to do the American Embassy. I think the British High Commission, they're setting up their own organic veggie patch. They started to have a competition. Wouldn't it be great you know, if you have one in the lodge as well, you know, to grow. I'm trying to say to people, look, I know what it's like to go through a depression. Everybody's being a bit polite. Nobody knows what to do. They've never experienced what's happening with the present economic crisis, right? But we're about to fall into an economic abyss that will make 1929 look like an afternoon tea party. It is happening. They're meeting in London, but they don't know what to do, and they'll put out a communique that you'll read it and think, is that all? Right? And that they're going to do this, and they're trying to overcome the problem by giving more money to the very people who made the mess, you know? And so I'm saying to people, look, dig up your bloody lawn. Put some potatoes in. Plant carrots and parsnips and sweet corn and anything that will come, beans and peas and all these things. You can do it. You can do it anywhere in Australia as long as you've got the water, and you don't need all that much water. It's amazing how little you need if you do it properly, right? And if you do it organically. And people say, oh, but you might be wrong. We might get out of this in 3 months. Oh, that's bad news, isn't it? You know, I mean, there you are stuck with a brilliant veggie patch, you know. Right? Whereas before you had this useless lawn that used to mow, right? Come on. I mean, it's win-win. But what you get out of it, you know, is the greatest wealth of all. It's the sheer joy of hard physical work. And that sounds like a contradiction, but I mean it. Right? The sheer total joy of going out and working the soil and planting and sowing and pruning and harvesting and all these things, right? Of the greatest food of all, and what you get, bloody marvellous health. It's lovely to be healthy. It's lovely to be able to get out of bed in the morning and hardly wait to get out there to get stuck into it. Or to sit down as I do every day. Every day of the week, 7 days, I knock out 1,000 words for different articles and magazines that I write for, and I've just finished 2 books, right? It's lovely to do it, and if you're sitting there and you think, oh, bugger it, I'm sick of this, go out and start digging, right? Start pruning. It's wonderful. I'm saying it to everyone. This is living. This is life. This is what it's all about. And this is what it's like being 82.
Well, maybe it's time to take a question from the audience. Is there anybody who has a question?
Peter, I can't resist this. It's a good to get you on the spot. I tried before and not been able to, and I've never had this opportunity. As one Mancunian to another, how did you manage to get out of school at that young age? When I'm older than you, and when I was your age, the leaving age, the legal leaving age, was 14. So you must have been a bit of a wangler then, were you?
You left school at 12, is that right? Mm-hmm. You left school at 12?
Yes, right? I started work at 11, but I still went to school. And then when the war broke out in 1939, I was 12. And I was what they used to call a juvenile delinquent. It was lovely, right? I really was very bad, right? I was the naughtiest of all naughty boys, right? And I was always being called out, or they called the police out to me because I was on a roof somewhere. I once climbed up a chimney stack, right, on the inside, and on the top of a straight chimney stack on the top there. And they brought out the police, and it was wartime police, it was specials. What they call special, because most of the police had been called up, so they had these special policemen. And I'm on the top shouting out, you're only a bloody special, bugger off, you see. But I ran wild, you know, because there was no school. When they evacuated the children in Britain, they closed all the schools in the cities because all the kids went out. I only lasted 2 weeks where I was because I was such a naughty boy. I shouldn't say that. I was a boy that did naughty things. And here's a difference. And so when I came back, I had the whole of Manchester to myself, virtually. And I ran wild everywhere. My mother didn't know what to do. My father had long since gone. He was in the army. And she more or less, I ran away from home. I wanted to join the Navy at 12. You know, I had a ball, right? And then somebody said, we better give him something to do. So they gave me a job as a milk boy. And that meant I had a little bike with a kind of a basket on the front that was full of 12 pints of milk and 3 half pints. And I had to go to parts of... They used to deliver the milk with a little electric truck that was very quiet. And I had to go to places where the truck couldn't get to. And so I had all these to deliver. And, I mean, that was in the middle of winter. And it's interesting how you learn things. Because I'll never forget, it was very, very cold in that winter in 1939. So cold. And I'd get up at 5:30 in the morning and I'd deliver the milk and then I'd spend hours washing bottles and then in the evening I'd go off, or sometimes if there's any school open for an hour, as it was sometimes, I'd go to school for an hour. But mainly I was working for 5 shillings a week. That was my wage, which I gave to my mother. Right. But on one morning, and it's just interesting this, I came out and it had been snowing, started to melt, and then it froze. And it was about 4 or 5 degrees below freezing. And the road was like glass with frozen snow. And I came out on my bike, and I had to climb a hill. And I'm pushing this bike with a big load of bottles on the front. And the front wheel slipped. Now, I'd already dropped a crate of milk, or half a crate of milk. And the owner of the dairy said, that's your wages gone for the week. Right, so I was determined not to do it. And the front wheel slipped. And I had to take the whole weight of that basket and the bike and try and push it uphill. And I'll never forget this, because it was black as the ace of spades. It was very, very early in the morning, quite dark, very cold. And my feet are slipping and I'm pushing this uphill. And I kept muttering to myself, never give in, never give in. Never give in until I got to the top of that hill, right? And then I went on and did the deliveries. And since that time, no matter what I've been involved in, whether I've been involved in active service in the Korean War or in the Palestine War or in Europe, and I've had something strenuous to do that I think I'll never be able to do it, that little boy's voice comes into my head saying, never give in, never give in. And I say that to kids and to everyone. You never give up. You never stop fighting for what you believe is right. Yeah. You know, you never give in.
Now just going back to the war in Europe, this fascinating story of you crossing accidentally into enemy territory.
I'm going to swear. Right, I'm going to say a terrible word that's going to offend you. And it begins with F and it ends with K. And I will say this word, so if you feel like walking out and hiding, right, I once told this story and it was full of very religious people. And I said, look, I know how you are and I'm going to say this terrible word and I want to warn you. They all lean forward. But this is what happened. I'm in Austria. I was guarding the SS. We'd liberated the concentration camps. I spent hours with the people who had been the inmates of the camps. I learnt their stories. The stories they're told were infinitely more terrible than anything you've ever read. They were simply so bad, so serious, so awful that you cannot repeat them. And they told me these stories. And one day, I was a 19-year-old virgin soldier, and we were all virgins. We used to pretend we weren't, right? Oh, yes, it's dead easy. Haven't you ever had one? Oh, it's lovely, mate. Right? It never happened, because there was no pill in those days, and the terror of young women was being made pregnant, and the terror of young men was making someone pregnant. So, oddly enough, we treated young women, believe it or not, with great respect. We really did. But it didn't stop that yearning. And one day, I was in this place called St. Paul. We call it St. Paul, a little village in Austria. I've been guarding these SS people who were absolute, really low creatures. They were not men who had shiny hats and shiny boots. They were scruffy little, cowardly little men because the job they had in a camp, concentration camp, if they didn't like it, they were sent to the front, to the Russian front or elsewhere. So they did that. So they were the ultimate, absolute rubbish people, these awful. I was guarding them, but one day I was out in this old monastery at St. Paul, and it had an orchard round it, and it was August. And I see some apple trees. So I'm down, I'm looking at the apple trees and trying the apples. And suddenly, a voice behind me said, "Excuse me, but what is your name?" It was a soft female voice. I turned around, and there was a blue-eyed, magnificent girl of such beauty that my heart almost stopped beating. And she's carrying a basket with some apples, and she'd been picking them too. I said, "I beg your pardon." She said, "What is your name?" I said, "Peter." "Oh," she said, "Peter. I love the name Peter. Oh, Peter, oh, will you please take me for a walk?" All my wet dreams had come to fruition. I did, and she took me by this beautiful hand, took me by the hand and led me away. I was crippled with passion. I couldn't walk properly. I put my hand on my belt there to hide the wet patch that was appearing. It was embarrassing me. I told you it was going to be naughty. Gets worse. And she led me, and I didn't know that she was one of these people who were smuggling people from Croatia, who were fascists, over the border, who were being smuggled to Rome so they could get out before they were put on trial. And she was coming, and she needed a soldier with her so people wouldn't stop her. And I didn't know this. So we're chatting away, and it's only a few miles to the border of Slovenia, or what was then part of Yugoslavia. I didn't know there was a frontier, because she said, "Oh, we're going across this little brook, a creek." And we crossed it. And then she said to me, "Oh, we're now in Yugoslavia." "What?" You know. And she said, "Wait here, and I'll come back." And off she went, "And I'll take you back." I never saw her again. And innocent Pete, right? I'm walking along, feeling frustrated and still a virgin. And I came to a little road. I thought, walking down the road, and suddenly there was a roadblock. It was a frontier roadblock with guards in strange uniforms looking at me. So I then, who spoke no language, the only words I could speak was in German, was "Guten Morgen." So I said, "Guten Morgen," ducked under the bar and kept walking. All hell broke loose. They called out the guards. They arrested me, right? They charged me with espionage. They put me in prison in Maribor and then into another prison at Ljubljana. And I spent 6 months in solitary confinement. It did me no harm. When they threw me into that cell for the first time, I looked at this cell. I thought to myself, "Amazing, this is the first room of my own I've ever had." I'd had a rough life. It had my friends in there. It was full of lice and bugs. And I'd never seen lice. They got inside my belly button. And I had this itch, and I saw these things coming out. And if you have a louse, you can't go like that and squash it. It's like trying to squash a big grain of sand. You put it on there, you try and squash it with your fingernail, and it hurts your nail. It's still crawling around. I used to get the comb out of my pocket and crack it, and I killed them. Right? And then one day, I felt an itch under my arm, and you know, sometimes, we do it secretly, but we all do it. You feel a bit of a scab. I felt a scab, and I thought, and I pulled it off. Ugh. It had legs and was kicking. It was what they call a crab louse. And that was really hard to kill, right? So I had crabs, lice, fleas, and bed bugs. So, I mean, it was an entertaining 6 months in many ways. But it did me no harm, right? And when I came out, eventually, I did have a weird experience, which I won't repeat here, but I was a famous person came into my cell to look at me, because by this time, it was in the newspapers in Britain that this Peter Condall was in prison in Yugoslavia, and his mother had written to Winston Churchill, which he did, and he wrote to Josip Broz Tito, who they actually had a relationship. And all I know, I was released. And when I came out, I was sent back to my unit. And I'd been away for 6 months. And one day we had a regimental sergeant major who was a ferocious man. He had blue veins all over his face. They looked like a net. And a red nose. And eyes that were icy blue and deadly. And I was terrified of him. And he said to me, "Tomorrow you're going to be court-martialed, lad. You've been absent without leave," he said. "For 6 months. You're going to go in the nick." He said, "I believe you were with a wench." I said, "I went over with a girl, sir." "Ah," he said, "you went over with a girl, did you? Tell me, lad, did you get a fork?" I said, "Beg your pardon, sir." I was embarrassed. He said, "You heard what I said. Did you get a fork, lad?" I said, "No, sir." "You didn't get a fork? My God, what's the world coming to?" he said. The next day, he was there at the court-martial. I'm standing outside. "Get your hat off." You're not allowed to wear a hat when you... Right? "Right. Left turn. Quick march. Mark time. Left, right, left, right, left, right. Halt. Stand still. Stand still." I'm standing there. Five officers staring at me with utter contempt. They were the trial judges. And one of them said, "You really are, Private Condall, a most wretched man, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, sir." "He said, what? What are you?" I said, "A wretched man, sir." "He said, that's why you are a wretched man." He said, "You've been away for 6 months." "6 months," he said. "We'll have to fix him with this one. Mutter, mutter, mutter. We'll give him... Well, we've decided to sentence you to..." And just then the sergeant major spoke up. "I'd like to give evidence, sir. For this man, sir." He said, "Sergeant Major, this is most unusual. I want to give evidence, sir." "Oh, by all means. What do you want to say, Sergeant Major?" "I'd just like to point out, sir, that he never had a fork, sir." Consternation. "Is this true? Is this absolutely true?" And he said to me, "Is this true?" I said, "What, sir?" It's embarrassing. He said, "Isn't true, you never experienced carnal knowledge." I thought, "Carnal what?" I said, "Beg your pardon, sir." He said, "Did you or did you not experience carnal knowledge?" I said, "Her name wasn't Carmel, sir, it was Angela." They let me off on the grounds that I'd suffered enough. And I've got 6 months' back pay.
Okay, do we have another question from the audience?
Repeat them to the guy.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Peter, you forgot to tell us about how you used to wash in while you were in solitary confinement.
How you used to wash in solitary confinement, is that the question?
Oh, how? Oh, that, you're saying that on purpose. I think you've heard something. Look, I've got to tell you this. Look, when I was there, when I first got put in the nick, they turned up one day with my food for the day, which was a half a loaf of bread, and there was a jug of water on a little tiny table, and a bowl of rusty water, obviously, to wash in. I didn't like the smell of it. It was just real rusty. So I washed my face, right, and I could see the old eyepiece going slipped on. I could see this eye watching me, so I washed my face. I thought, I didn't want to get in the drawer under my arms, right? Didn't like the smell anyway, it was, right? But at least I was doing the right thing. And this went on for about a week, right? And after a while, when he came in, the eyepiece had slipped over, he'd watch, and then someone else would have a look, right? I thought they'd check in on me to see that I'm keeping myself clean. And then they said, we're now taking you down for interrogation. And marched me down, and there's about four men and a couple of women. And they said, now we are very worried about you, right? We are very worried about you. You've done these strange things. I said, yes, well, I followed the, with this girl. Come, no, not that. We cannot understand your behaviour. I said, well, when I wandered over the front here, no, not that. What we cannot understand is, why is it that every day you wash your face in our coffee? I thought, story of my bloody life, you know.
Now, you came to Australia because you volunteered for the Australian Army while you were in England. Mm. You came to Australia after volunteering for the Army.
Look, I was demobilised from the British Army in 1948. I'd just come back from the Palestine. It was a war, Palestine, 1945, 1948. No one talks about it, by the way, the Palestine War, but there was about 230-odd British soldiers were killed in that war. And the enemy were the people who are now running Israel. Right? I'm sorry to say this, but they were. They were the people that their fathers and mothers, right? They were terrorists, right? And they were killing people. And, I didn't hate them. I'd just come from the camps, right? And I'd seen how the way the Jewish people had been persecuted, and socialists and communists and all the others, right? I met a lot of them and talked to them. So when I came back to Britain and demobbed, and I went back to being a bus conductor and doing a bit of gardening. And to be a bus conductor is the most boring job. But you had to do it because they said, you've got to do it because that's the way it's working when you get demobbed. You must go back to your original job, which I loathed. Because when you collect fares on a bus, when you've finished, they all get off and another lot get on. You've got to start all over again, you see. So I thought, I've got to get out of this. And one day I saw a little ad in the paper and it said, volunteers wanted for the Australian Army. So I thought, I'll answer this. And they sent me a ticket to go to London to be interviewed. And down I went. There's a group of other blokes there, all fully trained. I was in the British Parachute Regiment, fully trained, right? And they asked me about myself, this, that and the other. Yes, very good, blah, blah, blah. Okay, no problem. Sign you up. Before you do, what did you do in the British Army? I said, I was a librarian, I said. They said, that's exactly what we want. They said, have you ever heard of Bondi? I said, no, what is it? Bondi is a beach in Sydney. We've got a military library there. It's only open a couple of hours a day. You can spend most of the time swimming. Sergeant's rank. I couldn't believe it. On the boat coming out, there was about 200 other blokes had signed up. I said to one bloke, what are you? He said, I'm going as a surveyor. A surveyor, eh? He had sergeant's rank, nothing to do. I said, have you done it before? No, he said, I was in the infantry, same as you, you know. Oh, another bloke, he said, he's going as an official military photographer. He'd once had a brownie box. When we got to Melbourne, they put the whole lot of us in the infantry, and a couple of months later, we're in Korea. I was sitting behind a machine gun, wondering what happened to me, you know. I mean, because, you see, what happened when the Korean War broke out in July 1950, and the Australians became involved, they had no troops. And someone said, hang on, it cost in those days somewhere around about 20 to 30,000 pounds to train an infantry soldier. They were getting us out for the price of the passage, right? Fully trained, absolutely. Expert in everything, map reading, field craft, every possible weapon, you know. So I finished up behind a machine gun in Korea, right? Which was weird because while I was over there, you'd meet people in the British Army that was in the Commonwealth Division, and they'd say, are you in the Australian Army? And you're from Manchester? Yeah. What's it like in Australia? I don't know. We never had a chance to stop. But no, it's actually it's the best thing I ever did. You know, it's the best thing I ever did to come here. It's interesting. You've got to move around. I went back a few times to Britain. I won a Winston Churchill Fellowship in 1974, which allowed me to go back because they paid my fare. I went to through the United States and Britain, you know, and Africa as well, you know. And poor little darling. And one of the amazing things about being an old geezer, and I wonder if any old blokes here have the same thing. But if you see in a supermarket, you see some little toddler crying, it makes me want to cry. And I don't know why, right? I find it terribly, don't get me wrong, that's different. But when they're crying away, you see a little kid that are so tired, and they're hanging on there, and the mother belts them because they're embarrassed. You see such cruelty in these places. And you see some poor little kid crying away there because they're so tired. And the awful noise that you get, the awful music in supermarkets and these revolting announcements. You can imagine all these rotten vibrations of total greed coming through. No wonder they get upset and you just want to put your arms around them. I do. And just hold them. But you're not allowed these days, you see. And I still do. I just kneel down and I hold their hand, their little hot, sweaty hand, you know, I really do, and say, oh, you poor little thing. And it happened last week. I saw a little girl running in a supermarket. I found it so upsetting. And she was only 4. And she was crying and running around and crying and carrying a carton of eggs. And crying away with these carton of eggs running up and down. And I thought, what can you do, right? And then I went there and got my little loaf of bread, whatever, and I'm leaving. And I went round to get some money out the automatic teller. And the woman there is next to me shouting out, don't go away or you'll get into trouble again. And I looked and there was this same little girl. And I said, was that the little girl? And the little girl still had a carton of eggs. And I said, was that the little girl running around crying before? She says, yes, she keeps running away and getting lost and getting frightened. I said, it broke my heart, right, to see her. It's her own fault, she said, right? Young women are much harder than me, right? But no, it's one of the strange things about being old. One of the great tragedies about men is they spend their lives brimming with unshed tears or suppressed tears, but when you get older, you can't hold them back anymore. And it's so embarrassing. It's so embarrassing.
I think we've got a question up the back there.
I'm in perfect health, apart from I was a machine gunner. It destroyed everything in here. Yeah. So that's why I'm getting, if you don't mind, Stephen, to repeat
it. We'll make sure we get the right questions.
And it's also that we're behind the speakers, so we can't hear properly. You can hear, you know.
Peter.
That's another excuse, actually.
Peter, you've played a very prominent role in the campaign against the guns pulp mill on the Tamar. It seems that so many of our really key environmental issues come out of Tasmania. Can you tell us what it's like today being a prominent conservationist there, and has there been a personal cost for you?
So, yeah, the question is, you've been involved in environmental issues in Tasmania, a number of which are recent, the pulp mill and so forth. Can you tell us a bit about how that is at the moment, and has there been any personal cost to you?
In a way, yes. For example, it's a small place. Fortunately, in the environmental movement in Tasmania, it is supported very, very widely. It's got an enormous number of people that support it. Nobody, for example, and I've never met anyone apart from those with a vested interest, that supports this dirty, rotten, stinking pulp mill that they want to put in the Tamar Valley. I hope you'll see how I never call it a pulp mill. I always put the words dirty, rotten, stinking in front of it just to make sure that they know exactly how I feel. The ABC, for example, used to go out of their brain, you know, to try and shut me up. But what can they do with an old geezer? Sack me? Big deal, you know. And, you know, they say, oh, well, you're now not getting involved. And why not? What's wrong with being involved? You know, what's wrong with it? Right? And you see, you've got to do these things. When it comes to, I've been involved in every campaign, not just against for the environment and to protect it, but against war. I've been a soldier in three wars. My first experience of war was as a 13, 14-year-old in the Manchester Blitz, as a messenger boy running through the burning streets and seeing bodies everywhere. All right, I saw the horrors of the concentration camp. I saw what happened in the horrors, and it was horrible, in the Palestine War. And in Korea, when I arrived there, the hillside was covered with dead bodies. It was covered with bodies rotting away, right? And with great masses of green grass around them as they were rotting, were feeding the grass, you know. And there were bodies everywhere. I've seen it. And so it's turned me, and you'll never meet an old digger, an old soldier that likes war. You don't see it. You see these old geezers from the First World War, and they say, what do you think? They say, never have a war. They've been there. And have you noticed, and this is the thing, that whenever I'm publicly interviewed, not like this, but on air, on television, and they ask me about these things, and I always say one thing, which is never, ever goes to air. It is never repeated, right? And that's why I always say at a place like this. And what I say, have you ever noticed that the people who send young men and women to war are never the ones that go themselves? They're never the ones that go themselves. And that is always edited out. It's always edited out, right? And why? I don't know. But it is a fact of life that the people that send young people to war, and if you read the newspapers, right, pick up the Australian, and you see these kind of people in the extraordinary editorial policy they have now, which is almost like as if it comes straight out of the neocons in the White House or from the Israeli embassy. That's it. That's their policy, right? Very, very right. I'm talking about Likudnik policy, right? That's what you get in there. And you read these journalists, you know, that write... let's have another war, let's extend our troops to Afghanistan, let's send more of them. Greg Sheridan, he's never seen a war in his life. He's never been anywhere. You know, and there he was. These people are experts. They've never been anywhere, they've seen nothing, they've done nothing, and they're experts on everything, and they've got their columns in the paper. Andrew Bolt, right? Never been anywhere, never seen anything, never done anything, but they love war as long as somebody else goes, right? And I get angry about this, right? And I say it if I meet them, right? But what I'm saying is true. Read the columns if you can be bothered, right? And so I'm against war. What happens? Right, sometimes in environmental things, the people who... I'm fighting against those, not the blokes that are working in the forests, right? They have a rotten job. They're covered in leeches. They're cutting down trees, right? They're pouring in the pouring rain. They're there in the forest cutting down trees. Right, but they think that people like me are their enemies. They want to beat me up, right? Or they want to come round and find out where I live so they can burn me out. Yes, that's right. Why? Not because they're bad, but because the work of any person involved in the environment, it makes them think they're taking away our livelihood. We are attacking their families, their children, their wives. Right, they feel that, and they're defending what they think is theirs. And yet, that many of them are so poorly paid. If you're driving around Tasmania, you'll see the huge log trucks everywhere. The drivers get a terrible rate of pay. And if they have an accident, they get dumped. One of my best mates, driving a log truck, top heavy, it fell over. It ripped off his ear completely, right? He lost his ear completely, broke his arm, broke his ribs, right? He crawled out. Cars are going past, he's bleeding away. He couldn't get anyone to stop. Right? And eventually, that was it. Went into hospital. Nobody came to see him. His so-called trade union official, and I'm speaking as a bloke who joined a trade union in 1941 and proudly walked 9 miles to a meeting and came back at 3 o'clock in the morning, excited about what I'd done, right, of being involved in this wonderful thing. Now you get trade union officials, like with the forestry union officials, they're so close, they're part of the boss. Right? And they never see them. They just dump their own people. I get angry. I am full of passion. I mean that. I'm full of passion against injustice of any kind, against war, against the destruction, and above all, about the thing that drives the destruction of everything and the destruction of the environment and war, and that's greed. Greed, it's a driving force, and it's got to be fought against, and I'll fight against it.
Okay,
you never expected to get anything like this, did you? From this rather nice gardener that's showing you how to put carrots in.
Okay, we have another question at the back there.
Bug of the garden. Can we have something on an update as to what is actually happening at the Dirty Despicable Guns proposed pulp mill, please?
So, yeah, an update on the guns. Do you know, on the guns pulp mill, the dirty, stinking pulp
It's mill? Dead. It's rotting in the water, but it won't lie down, right? They're hoping to get finance, right? But you see, their share value has slumped. It was about $3.50, $4 about 3 years ago. It's now slumping down. It's about 80 cents right now. But they keep saying, we still have hope. We'll still hope to get the money. Where are they going? Who's going to lend them money, right, guns? Who's going to lend it to them? And you see, the politicians, here's the interesting thing. The politicians, they know it's dead, but they don't say so. Do you know why? It's most interesting, this, because I asked one of them, right? I said, why is it you never say out when you say the thing's dead? He said, we don't. He said, if a person from, said, guns are looking for a scapegoat because they can't get the money. Right, they've spent $100 million of their shareholders' money fiddling around on this useless project and this destructive project, and they're trying to get that money back. It's no use suing Peter Condall. I've got bugger all, right? But they're looking for a government, and one government minister's only got to say, "I'm against that mill." Right, it's a waste of space, and guns, they've done it. They say, there it is, that's why we can't get money. The government's stopping us. They've just destroyed our credibility. We'll now sue you for the $100 million. Really? Really? It happened. It was a brand new minister in Tasmania, a young woman. They asked her, what do you think about the pulp mill? She said, I think it's dead. I don't think it'll get off the ground. Instantly, John Gay, the head of guns, got up and said, that's why we can't get money. Right? And immediately the Premier, the Treasurer and everybody else says, no, we support the mill. Right? Don't take any notice of her. The Cabinet support the mill. She's outvoted. You know, that's what it's all about. It'll die a lingering death, but it's already dead. And it's bloody marvellous.
Well, believe it or not, that's actually an hour that we've been sitting here talking. It seems to.
For those that fell asleep.
So we have to, thank obviously Peter Cundall for taking the time to visit us and for giving us such wonderful stories. So on behalf of the National Museum, thank you very much, Peter. And could you join me in thanking Peter once again?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to come here. I do think that Canberra is one of the great, elegant cities of the world. I really love it here. I might add that when I came back from the Korean War, I was still in my summer uniform, KD's, and I got on a bus, this is 1952, got on a bus to come to Melbourne, and it stopped in Canberra in the second week in July at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I got out and wandered around these strange, deserted streets. And I'd just come back from the Korean War where the temperature was 30 degrees below freezing, right, but not there at that time of the year. And I couldn't believe that the cold could be so intense. Right, I walked around, I thought, I don't believe it. I don't believe that Australia could be so cold. But I love this place. I think it's a marvellous place to be. Yeah, great place. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.